So good morning, everybody. Before we gavel the council into in session work, how many of you are here to plan on testifying? How many of you have testified before? Okay. For those of you that have not, it's really easy. Carla, our great council clerk, will call the names as folks have signed up. And all you have to do is come to the table here. You only need to give us your first and last name. We do not want your address. Just your first and last name. And then there's a clock on the front of that big hunk of wood that will count down from 3 minutes. And that's all you have to do. You'll hear the buzzer. One beep will indicate 30 seconds left, and then three beeps means you're over 3 minutes, and if you go over four, that seat becomes electrified. Not really. So as soon as we get a quorum, we'll get started here. We're glad you're here today. All right, we're all here. Oops. Good morning. Today is Wednesday, September 30th, 2009. It's 9:30 in the morning. The morning session of the Portland City Council will come to order. Carla, would you please call the roll?
Saltzman. Leonard. Here. Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Adams.
Here. We take communications first. We have five people signed up. Carla, can you please read the title for communications, item number 1350?
Request of Nan Stark to address council regarding method of funding public services.
Ms. Stark, please come forward. Welcome to the City Council. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor Adams, members of the council. My name is Nan Stark. I am a city planner with the Bureau of Development Services. When two colleagues first came here to talk to you last month about the BDS financial situation, you encouraged us to continue to advocate for our bureau, and I'm here today to do that. One thing that this situation has made clear is that council needs to address the city's budget holistically. BDS should not have to face this alone. This is a crisis. It's not simply a budget issue. It's a major crisis that has occurred because services provided by BDS cannot be sustained in a downward economy on fees alone, and many of the services that we provide are not fee-based. This is a crisis because what's happening to BDS now is likely going to be happening to most, if not all, city bureaus over the next few months and years. I'm here today to ask you to consider some solutions to the current problem and to address the budget crisis that will soon face other bureaus. First, use city reserves to reinstate some positions at BDS to bring it back to a reasonable and sustainable level of service. Second, revise the BDS budget to more accurately reflect the amount of non-fee-based services that the Bureau provides, which would be more like a 60-40 split of fees to general funds. Third, require every non-essential city employee to take furlough time by the end of the year. Informal polling shows that most employees are willing to work reduced hours or take furloughs to save jobs and to preserve service levels. And fourth, institute a strategic plan by the Auditor's Office and Bureau of Human Resources to address the massive numbers of employees who will be affected by layoffs, bumping, and general upheaval. The BDS situation needs to be seen as a glimpse of things to come. I'm not being dramatic in painting this picture as upheaval. BDS had 300 employees on July 31st. Tomorrow there will be 148. I want to emphasize that BDS provides services that affect and help every member of the community. We work with the development community on a daily basis in ensuring that construction projects can continue. We work with the design community, with nonprofits, with neighborhood associations in hearing and addressing their concerns, and we work with individual citizens and their neighbors to ensure the safety and livability of all Portlanders. It's a holistic system we're working under. And I ask you to look at the BDS crisis as a crisis that affects you. It affects every commissioner who has projects that are related to neighborhoods, parks, schools, housing, commercial, and more. And projects that need water, transportation, that include neighborhood involvement, sustainability, police and fire services, and other emergency services. In other words, what we do crosses all bureau lines. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Nan. I appreciate your remarks.
Thank you for your thoughtful testimony. Can you please read the title for communications item number 1351?
Request of Jason Renaud to address council regarding the third anniversary of the death of James Chassie.
Mr. Renaud, welcome to the City Council. Glad you're here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
There we go.
My name is Jason Renaud. I'm a volunteer board secretary for the Mental Health Association of Portland. Our mission is to help persons with a mental illness speak up and speak out, and this is a community of persons who ask you to rebuild the respect and trust damaged between the Portland Police Bureau and persons with a mental illness. I'd like to talk this morning about impunity. This is when a person or an institution has been exempted from punishment. Impunity is a corrosive to public administration and extremely hard for partisans to distinguish from righteousness or understand the damage that it causes. It occurs when there is a wide variance between what is found to be just and what is understood to be true. The action which enables impunity to flourish is when persons of authority claim due process is equal to justice, or somehow justice always prevails. Our organization and thousands of people in Portland believe an injustice has prevailed, that a fair hearing on what happened to James Chassie has not occurred. The final opportunity for intervention was an internal review of the officer's actions and a decision whether those actions were within police and policy. After 3 years, the Bureau distributed a press release last week, citing reasons their review was late, for the most part. A minor technicality was found, so a minor punishment may occur. What has occurred is impunity. The message delivered is a brutal beating and death of a person with mental illness, one with caregivers and friends and family and a home and a clean record, is acceptable by and within the Portland Police Bureau. This should not be acceptable to you. Impunity undermines and dissolves the most important tool police officers need to do their work, trust and respect. I've given you seven actions that we believe can help rebuild this trust and respect that you can act on, I think, quickly. Number one, release the full investigation by the Portland Police Bureau of what happened to James Chassie. Number two, move the three officers off patrol duty. Number three, make a goal of reducing taser use by 50% per year over the next 5 years. Four, reopen the chief's forum. Five, form a joint effort with local governments and local police departments and mental health advocates to go to Salem to get the money we need to provide the appropriate mental health services. Number six, open a sincere and staffed and public meeting between people with mental illness and the police bureau. Number four, release the crisis intervention team curriculum to public inspection and encounter data. It's time for you to act. It's your turn. Thank you.
Thank you for your thoughtful testimony. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and thank you for sending in your testimony ahead of time. That was very helpful. Commissioner Saltzman has a scheduled absence today. He, of course, is in charge of the Police Bureau, but I did have a conversation with him yesterday. And as you know, I'm a former mental health nurse, and I will be working with Office of Human Relations, which is in my charge with the Community and Police Relations Committee, with Commissioner Saltzman and the Police Bureau to continue working on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Carla, can you please read the title for Council Communications item number 1352?
Request of Sophie Liu to address Council regarding persecution in China.
Ms. Liu, welcome to the City Council. We're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Please have a seat.
Good morning. My name is Natalie Teplitsky.
Can you move that microphone? There.
Yeah.
Thank you.
My name is Natalie Teplitsky. I'll be reading it on behalf of Sophie Liu because her English is limited. I'm a Falun Gong practitioner, escaped from the concentration camp in Beijing 3 years ago. Since 1999, the Chinese Communist Party kidnapped me 4 times. I was forced into an iron cage and was not allowed even to go to the bathroom. My white pants were soaked with urine and blood. Merely because I refused to say slanderous words about Falun Gong, a policeman tied my hands and feet together and was repeatedly beating me severely until I lost consciousness. I now have a permanent scar on my forehead. They forced me to work as a slave day and night. I was injected with an unknown drug that made me sleepy all the time and caused memory loss. They even tested my blood several times, and if it matched to any patients who needed organs, I would have been murdered. I was so lucky to escape to this land of freedom. On September 15th, I attended Ambassador Wu lecture at the World Affairs Council of Oregon. The repercussions of the cunningly crafted speeches Mr. Wu delivers to American audiences are very serious. Not only does he present U.S. citizens with skewed information, but it is simultaneously being used by Communist Party to further advance their agenda. I was surprised to find out that while I was at the meeting upstairs, one of Mr. Wu's accomplices was rudely demanding that my friends who were waiting for me in the lobby reveal my name to him. This is one of the many examples of how CCP, Communist Party, is extending its persecution to the USA. One of the examples of the serious consequences of Wu's propagandistic agenda was his response to an Oregonian reporter's question about Falun Gong, which was immediately picked up by the Chinese pro-communist website, where strategically selected snippets of the articles were displayed under the revised title, Wu Jianmin, People Regard the Falun Gong as Sort of Cult. It is not only slander, but a means of legitimizing the persecution of millions of Falun Gong practitioners. As a matter of fact, Wu used a diplomatic position in France to further his government's policy of eradicating Falun Gong. He organized and sponsored many conferences and exhibits with the aim of instigating hatred towards Falun Gong and its founder, Mr. Li, a 4-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee. But what is Falun Gong in reality? As taken from U.S. Congress Resolution number 188, which was passed unanimously by 420 congressmen, Falun Gong is a peaceful and nonviolent form of personal belief and practice with millions of adherents around the world. Michael Horowitz, director of Hudson's Institute Project for Civil Justice and International Religious Liberty, called Falun Gong practitioners the pathfinders for democracy in China and therefore keepers of the hope for the world and for the 21st century. I am really worried that Portland authorities give a green light to communist leaders like Mr. Wu, for whatever reason they might have. As Congressman Dana Robebacker put it, history cares not whether we inked another trade deal or helped to sell another Boeing, but history will judge us if we choose to look the other way when faced with truly indescribable human suffering on this scale. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your thoughtful testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Carla, can you please read the title for Council Communications, item number 1353?
Request of Raphael Goodblatt to address Council regarding small business and the recent layoffs at the Bureau of Development Services.
Welcome to the City Council Chambers. Glad you're here.
Thank you. My name is Rafe Goodblatt. I'm an architect and a life safety reviewer with BDS. Today is my last day. I've worked for the City of Portland for 6 years, and just so you know, I love my job. Prior to working here, I owned a design business for 8 years. Here's what I've seen in the last 6 years. I see a business model that is impossible to maintain. As you know, BDS is an enterprise bureau. That means we must succeed with the funds we take in. Unfortunately, every person who interacts with development services thinks it is funded with taxes. That causes big problems. People who work at the city are expected to complete thousands of hours of research. They draw for people. They design structural and mechanical systems and much more, all for free. Currently, revenue is down and all reserves are gone. What is left? Tomorrow, BDS will be down to 148 employees from a total of 350. Our manager-to-employee ratio will be about 1 to 6. The average for a well-run company is about 1 to 21. BDS has triple the managers. This proportion creates fear in the managers and fear throughout the Bureau. Managers can be fired at a moment's notice. Managers cost more than union employees. This fear has already been felt outside BDS by the neighborhood associations. I got a call asking me to speak about their fear. They are afraid that BDS cannot meet the citywide violation inspections. How do we erase the fear, practice successful business techniques, and rebuild the reserves? If you want to have an enterprise bureau, then do not use the bureau's money to fund projects that do not bring in revenue. The oddest example is biodiesel. The funniest, in a sad way, was the infomercial. Did all of you know that BDS made an infomercial? I wonder what that infomercial cost. The next suggestion is to return the manager-employee ratio to a business-healthy level and start advertising to all applicants that BDS is revenue-based and not tax-based. BDS will have to tell applicants BDS cannot help them until they complete more work with the help of professionals. These professionals can help the applicant with the permit process. If BDS stopped giving advice for free and started teaching applicants how to find professionals, many small offices would have a great deal of work. Here's one way BDS could connect people to professionals they need. Portland Maps can list the contractors and professionals who are listed in the permit applications. I already spoke with IT, and this is very possible. New applicants need professional help. Could see who is doing all the work to get permits. Currently, BDS employees are afraid to give out names of professionals for fear of reprisals from managers and liability. I do know that in 6 years, I never had any complaints from an applicant who I helped find professionals. The only times there were complaints was when an applicant had crappy drawings and they felt I was not being helpful enough. In the end, I wish you all the luck. I wish that you would start listening to people who actually do the job every day instead of this top-down management system that is just plain broken. Yes, I think you should provide some general fund money, but if you don't, at least return some basic business practice and show respect to the community of Portland and the employees of BDS. And right on time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Carla, can you please read the title for Council Communications, item number 1354.
Request of Kim Carlson to address Council regarding Right Around Portland.
Ms. Carlson. Hi, welcome to the City Council Chambers. Glad you're here. I understand you're going to say a few words, and I'm supposed to say a few words, and then you're going to wrap up. Is that right?
I'm going to say a few words, and then I'll be done.
Okay.
And you can do whatever you want.
Have you got that straight, Mayor Adams?
I do.
So good morning, Mayor Adams and City Commissioners. My name is Kim Carlson, and I am the chair of the Board of Directors of Right Around Portland. I'm honored to be with you today to accept the Mayor's proclamation honoring Right Around Portland's 10th anniversary and to tell you about this inspired and inspiring venture. Right Around Portland provides 10-week writing workshops to people who, because of social or financial barriers, may not otherwise find their way to such a workshop. Then we publish the work of these writers in a beautiful anthology and host a public reading where they can share their work with the broader community. These readings are singular events that make me feel both incredibly proud and incredibly humble. I'll try to paint you a picture of one. Imagine a spacious room at the First United Methodist Church in Southwest Portland. It's 7 p.m. on a Thursday night, and 300 people have come to read or listen to readers from the most recent series of workshops. Honestly, this is one of the most diverse audiences you'll find in Portland. Happily, there is no animosity. Everyone is here to listen with respect to what others have written. These readings bring out the best in people. Along with the writers who have participated in a Write Around Portland workshop and now are sharing work with the larger community, there are family members and friends, many of whom are moved to tears and cheers. But these are public readings, And it's important to say that many in the audience are community members who have come simply because they appreciate the range of voices they'll hear over the course of the evening. Let me tell you who might be at the podium. A 15-year-old boy from an alternative high school who's been involved in a gang. A 21-year-old woman with cerebral palsy who is in a wheelchair and required a volunteer transcriptionist to write her story. Seniors from an assisted living center in outer northeast Portland. A woman with stage 4 metastatic cancer who wants to write something to leave behind for her family. The parent of a soldier who is serving his third tour in Iraq. A young man with autism whose participation in our workshop is his only social outlet. A man who found in writing the ability to overcome his meth addiction. A woman who drove all the way from Lebanon, Oregon, to read the story she wrote while she was incarcerated and participating in our workshop at the state women's prison. A teenage girl who shares her story of being a parent. A woman in the audience told one of our board members recently that for years she's attended every single Ride Around Portland reading, and for her they are sacred experiences. I have that same sentiment. And I have to say something about our four-person staff, as well as the 2,500 participants we've had over 10 years, the 900 volunteers. The staff is stellar. They are hardworking, kind, and thrifty people who manage to reach a lot of Portlanders working on a tight budget, always with much goodwill. Right Around Portland is quintessentially Portland. There's nothing else like us, although we have inspired other organizations in Seattle, New York, Arizona, North Carolina, and elsewhere. Right Around Portland reflects Portland's community and contributes to what makes Portland such an iconic place. Thank you for recognizing our 10th anniversary year.
And I'm very pleased to read a proclamation to mark this great milestone of 10 years, whereas more than 2,500 adults and youths have, many of which are the most isolated and financially insecure citizens of Portland, have participated in Ride Around Portland's acclaimed writing workshops, whereas Ride Around Portland has inspired participants to complete their GEDs, attend college, stick with treatment programs, break cycles of abuse, and find value in their stories and in themselves. And whereas Ride Around Portland's writing workshop has included some of the most diverse voices and audiences in Portland, now on your 10th anniversary, congratulations, I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, do hereby proclaim 2009 as Ride Around Portland's 10th anniversary and commend the observance to all citizens. Congratulations. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to first thank the mayor for the proclamation and for the recognition, and I want to give you an additional chance to let people know how they can support your good work, and in addition, I want to put a plug in for the Oregon Cultural Trust, which thinks very highly of your work. So if someone wants to contribute to Right Around Portland, how would they do so?
One of the easiest and obviously most modern ways is to go to our website, which is www.rightaround.org. There is a donate button, and we appreciate that. I also wanted to mention, thank you for the opportunity to mention, that this Saturday night at Design Within Reach in the Pearl District, there will be a yearly celebration fundraiser for Right Around Portland called X, Y, and Z.
So I just want to put a plug in for two ways people can support you. They can go to your website and give you $100.
Exactly.
But you also are highly regarded by the state of Oregon through the Oregon Cultural Trust, which I have the honor of serving on. So if they then give a matching contribution to the Oregon Cultural Trust,
absolutely,
they get two benefits. One is that the Cultural Trust will continue to give you grants for doing your good work. And in addition, that $100 comes back to an Oregon taxpayer as a 100% credit on their tax return. So the additional $100 costs them nothing.
Thank
so
you.
I would encourage people to do that.
Absolutely. Thank you for explicitly.
Thanks for your good work. I'll give you this proclamation. Carla, I think we're going to the consent agenda. Is that right? Does anyone wish to pull any item from the consent agenda? Hearing none.
I do.
Oh, okay.
1369.
1369 is pulled from the consent agenda. Anything else? All right. Carla, would you please call the roll on the consent agenda?
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Consent agenda is approved.
If we could go right to that.
Sure. Please read the title for consent agenda item that has been pulled, item number, emergency ordinance item number 1369.
Authorize an agreement with Portland Downtown Services, Inc. to provide commercial inspection services in the Downtown Business Improvement District.
Commissioner Leonard.
Some of the employees at the Bureau of Development Services are rightly upset about losing their jobs. I want to, why don't you guys come forward. But I want to put in a better context the reaction that has occurred as a result of this horrible dynamic. And first, to make clear that for those who are in a position where they're not going to lose their job, I hope you can appreciate psychologically what it is like to have the means by which you make your house payment, you send your kids to school, you put food on the table, you do the things you take for granted every day in life, get destroyed when you lose your job. There's nothing more fundamental than the right of a person to have a job and provide for themselves. And I fought for that my entire adult life, to actually have to be in the position where I'm actually meeting with people, and I have, that are losing their job, is the darkest day in my political career. It is not something I ever envisioned being able to do. But in reaction to that, I want to also put in context that when I found out how bad the economy was going to be, specifically, as we've heard here today from the testifiers from BDS, the lack of building permits that would cause what has happened to happen, which hasn't been accurately portrayed by those that have testified, I directed all the managers and included myself to take a 2-week unpaid furlough. None of the rest of the council did that. Some took a pay freeze of about 2.9%. This unpaid furlough amounts to a 4% wage cut. I also directed that that money go back to the Bureau, not to the City General Fund, including my money, to keep represented people and employees of the Bureau working. There is a man that answers the phone at my front desk that would have been a laid-off AFSCME employee. I brought him there. I directed the Water Bureau, the Fire Bureau, to take on otherwise laid-off employees into positions that they'd be qualified to fill. This ordinance is one more example of another strategy we've used to keep, it ends up keeping one position. One of our inspectors at the Bureau of Development Services is assigned to inspect the most dangerous and inhabitable occupancies in the city. So if the council recall, some time back, we discovered that the Grove Hotel was, to be polite, a flea bag hotel wherein which the most vulnerable people in our community, mentally ill, addicted to drugs, addicted to alcohol, and typically suffering from all three, were being extorted to pay $550 a month for a room you wouldn't let your dog live in. I went into the rooms. I was a firefighter for 25 years. I had never been in such appalling conditions anywhere, and people were living in them. You know what they did when the sink backed up? They took the sink out of the bathroom. The toilet backed up, they closed the toilet for human beings. This position was part of three people that went in and changed that. And if you go to the Grove today, you'll find places that people live that you would feel comfortable having your aging parents live in. That's the difference. So I went to the business community, and I sat them down. And I said, we are in a crisis mode at the Bureau of Development Services, and that's not an over-exaggeration of the term. As you heard here today, on July 1st, 2008, we had 351 people working at the Bureau of Development Services. Tomorrow, we will have 148 people working at the Bureau of Development Services. You cannot deliver the same level of services with that number of people without radically thinking how you're going to rechange doing your job. And I will not get into that other than to say that as radical as people think that I am, I have stretched my own boundaries to redefine how we're delivering those services, and we are. This position, however, we could not afford to lose, but we couldn't afford to keep. And I went to the business community, and I said, would you agree to fund this position for 1 year? And why would the business community pay for a person that goes out and potentially closes down businesses that pays you dues? Because you don't want those folks as your members. They provide inhabitable places for people to live. They provide safe drug havens. They provide places to go eat in restaurants that if they catch on fire will trap people in them and they will die. And this person that's assigned to this team, along with the fire marshal and along with the police officer, addresses those problems for the first time in Portland's history. And they have a success rate that is unparalleled. And the people that see them come through the door know that the rules have changed when these three folks come through the door. The games they've played up till then, the exploitation they've done up till then, they know is about to come to an end. Their reputation now precedes them. The business community discussed it and agreed to fund that position, for which I am extremely grateful. So I pulled this off the consent agenda, given the context of the discussions here earlier and the context of what has happened at the Bureau of Development Services, to make the point that not only do I hear what these folks are saying, I'm doing everything I know how to keep as many people working as is creatively possible. And I don't know if you three have anything to add to that.
Paul Scarlett, Bureau of Development Services Director. I can echo what Commissioner Leonard has said. And in addition, we have explored and turned over every rock in terms of cost-saving measures. We are also the only bureau that has approved and are utilizing extended leave,
furlough. Emergency.
Not furlough.
E-time.
E-time, excuse me. it's one that allows people to be off without pay and keep their vacation accruals going. It is something that we're proud of. We have and will continue to explore not just cost-saving but efficiency measures. And this is one of those efficiency measures that does repay the community in dividends in terms of safety and health. And we will continue to work with our industry partners, our business partners, to try and weather this storm. It is a crisis, and we are hearing all the testimonies, and we are responding and doing as much as we possibly can.
Thank you, Paul.
Unless the two other of you have anything to say, appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. Is there anyone that would also like to testify on Council Calendar Item Emergency Ordinance 1369? Carla, would you please call the roll?
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
I very much support this program and appreciate Commissioner Leonard's work and also the business communities to finance this position. And I proposed the merit pay freeze at the end of June to look at other things that we need to do to fund services for citizens citywide. Council chose to defer that discussion until October, but I'm still looking forward to having that. And I want everybody to know that this council is dedicated both to looking after employees and providing services to citizens, and we'll continue to work on that. Aye.
Aye.
Adams.
We also just want to thank Commissioner Leonard for his creativity on this one position and also for the extra efforts that he and his team are making to place folks that are being laid off due to the economic conditions and other positions around the city. Our work there will continue. Aye. 1369 is approved. Can you please read the title for time certain resolution, item number 1355?
Urge Congress to enact the United States National Health Care Act, sponsored by Representative John Conyers.
Commissioner Leonard.
Thank you, Mayor Adams, colleagues, and it's great to see the folks out here that are in support of our action today, but particularly my friend Tom Leadham, who has led this effort. Tom is, I'm going to embarrass you a little bit, is one of my heroes in the labor movement and has been one of the most active teamsters in the United States, including running for president three times and he'll make it someday. And if not there, he belongs on the national stage. He is a true progressive labor leader, and I'm proud to count him as a friend. America's health system faces a deepening crisis. The crisis has three dimensions. First, the lack of universality. Second, the excessive costs rising much faster than general inflation. And finally, poor health outcomes compared to other developed nations. The U.S. spends 16% of its annual gross domestic product on healthcare delivery and administration, more than twice the average of the highly developed Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development nations. That translates to $7,290 per person and 2.5 times the developed nation's average. Yet, unlike those countries, the U.S. fails to provide universal health care. And the U.S. gets worse health outcomes despite the highest level of spending. A national tax-funded social insurance system like that proposed in House Resolution 676 is the only kind of health care reform that can address all three dimensions of the current health care crisis. First, let's talk about the lack of universal health care. According to the Congressional Budget Office, 50 million people in the United States lack health insurance. That is nearly one person in six. 50 million people also is one in four of those not covered under Medicare, Medicaid, the Veterans Administration health system, or the military health system. In other words, 25% of civilians who are not extremely poor and who are working age or are children lack health insurance in the United States. All other developed countries cover everyone at the lowest cost than does the U.S., at a much lower cost than the U.S. Let's talk about costs. The United States pays the highest proportion of our gross domestic product and the highest cost per person of any country in the world for administration and delivery of health care. Yet we fail to include everyone, and we get worse results. Private health insurance premiums are increasing at least twice as fast as the rate of inflation, making health insurance less and less affordable every year. If the present rates of growth continue, the average cost of health insurance will equal 100% of the average income of American workers by 2025. Every cent of your check would have to go to health insurance if the rate of any increases continues till 2025. In the private insurance sector, including private plans contracted for public employees by governments, between 20 and 30% of the costs do not deliver health care. Those costs go to inefficient private bureaucracies and profits of insurance companies. By contrast, administrative overhead in Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Administration are from 4 to 8%. Of all United States bankruptcies, 62% of them are due to medical expenses, and of all medical bankruptcies, more than 75% happen to people who already have health insurance. The proportion of medically related bankruptcies is rising because of rising deductibles and copays and lowered maximum benefits used to keep premiums from rising even faster than what they are, but you still pay for it out of your pocket. In 2007, nearly two-thirds of U.S. adults, or an estimated 116 million people, struggled to pay medical bills in the United States. They went without needed care because of cost, were uninsured for a time, or were underinsured, meaning they were insured but not adequately protected from the high medical expenses. In a survey of persons who were chronically ill in six developed countries, 51% of the Americans skipped needed care or drugs because of the cost. Australia was the next highest, with 36%. In the Netherlands, the proportion was 3%, and in the United Kingdom, 13%. We were 51%. Poor health outcomes and the quality of care issues is another subject. The United States ranked 37th in the last global survey of the overall effectiveness of the national health systems conducted by the World Health Organization. In the same survey, the United States ranked 72nd in a measure of cost efficiency, in other words, of the quality of the outcome for the amount of money spent, 72nd in the world. Here's what John Conyers, Representative John Conyers' resolution, House Resolution 676, would do. Entitled the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, as under the current Medicare system, doctors would remain private and their bills will be paid for out of tax dollars. Unlike Medicare, there would be no additional premiums. With this single-payer system, people could see any doctor they wanted, for any care they needed with no copays, no deductible, and no lifetime caps. If a person changed jobs or were laid off or became too sick to work, he or she would keep the same health care. A benefit that there are a number of people in this audience right now feel the impact of not having. House Resolution 676 would solve the universality problem by making everyone living in the United States eligible for Medicare. It would solve the immediate cost problem of including all the uninsured and ending underinsurance and vulnerability for those with insurance by realizing savings from cutting the hugely wasteful private insurance bureaucracy and profits. Premiums and out-of-pocket expenses would be replaced by taxes at a fixed known rate. Health benefits would be converted to wages and salaries, ending costs rising faster than incomes for workers or wage costs for employers. Over time, the bill would shift emphasis in care to health promotion, prevention, primary care, and early stage detection and disease management, thereby reducing costs. Likewise, compensation systems for providers would be reformed to be based on health effective results, not on the number or cost of services ordered. Existing Medicare would be stabilized by taking the high-risk, high-cost pool of elders and folding them into a population-wide universal risk pool, spreading everyone's costs and risks across the entire population, young and old, healthy or not. This is the last frontier in the fight for rights for all in this country. The right to be given the same medical care whether you are young or old, poor or rich, man or woman, healthy or not, is a right that is inherent in our existence. In the name of all that's right, and on behalf of those too weak and powerless to speak for themselves here today, I urge this council to support this urgent message of support to Congress in support of H.R. 76 and our universally respected President, Barack Obama. Thank you.
Nicely done.
I do. Tom, you're on. Good morning. You're running the hearing from this point on.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor Adams, Commissioner Leonard, Commissioner Fritz, Commissioner Fish. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of this important resolution. My name is Tom Leadham. I'm the principal officer of Teamsters Local 206, and for 23 years, I've been the chairman of our health care fund, a Taft-Hartley fund that's been providing health care benefits to thousands of Oregon families for more than 50 years. Here in Portland, I'm also a member of the Jobs with Justice Health Care Committee. Jobs with Justice is a coalition of more than 80 organizations representing labor, faith, and community groups. My years of work in healthcare administration have led me to the conclusion that a single-payer system, as embodied in H.R. 676, is the only way to provide healthcare to all Americans without spending more than is currently spent. Unlike many reform proposals, support for single-payer is coming from the bottom up, structures that are closer to people. Unions, churches, community organizations, and significantly state, county, and city governments. Single payer has been endorsed by the U.S. Conference of Mayors and specifically by a large number of cities, including Baltimore, Louisville, Indianapolis, Detroit, San Francisco, and Seattle. While the moral imperative of universal health care is undeniable, in my role, I look at the issue from a cost perspective. Simply put, in collective bargaining, the more money spent to maintain a schedule of benefits, the less money will be available for wages, pensions, or other economics. There are many examples of single-payer systems in the U.S., Medicare and the Veterans Administration the most obvious, yet elements of single-payer also exist with Taft-Hartley trusts and self-insured corporations. These concepts are not foreign nor radical. They just make good economic sense. Union trusts over the past 20 years have found ways to limit cost increases. Much of this cost containment has been accomplished through self-funding or self-insurance, to the extent possible, depending on the size of the trust and, therefore, the size of the risk pool. This concept of eliminating insurance profit is not limited to union trusts. Large corporations have done the same thing by simply absorbing the risk and hiring third-party administrators, or in some cases, insurance companies themselves, to simply pay claims based on the schedule of benefits. My experience has been that the larger the risk pool, the lower the per capita costs. Large groups are in a much improved position to negotiate better rates with providers of all health services, including prescription drugs. While our trust's annual cost increases are always less than insured plans, we are not immune to health care inflation. In collective bargaining, whether it be private or public sector, healthcare and who pays for it dominate the negotiations. Cost shifting to employees through increased deductibles, higher copays, and premium sharing have escalated to the point where workers are simply tapped out. For working families, the system is unsustainable. The journal American Family Physician in 2005 predicted that skyrocketing private health insurance costs are on track to consume all our average household income by 2025. Adjustments around the edges will not solve the problem. I've closely followed health reform efforts in the U.S. since the early 90s. I remember the Clinton proposals of 1994. Interestingly enough, we weren't the only society studying reform. At that time, Taiwan, a free market capitalist society, was also involved in healthcare reform. In 1994, 40% of the Taiwanese population had no health care. In 1995, they successfully implemented their new health care program. Today, that system is Taiwan's most popular government program. Polls show a more than 70% approval rating. More than 98% of the Taiwan population now has quality health care. Total health care spending in Taiwan is about 6% GDP, versus what approaches 17% GDP in the U.S. The Taiwanese are not so arrogant to think they can't learn from others. According to the director of the Taiwan National Health Program, Taiwan modeled their new program after our Medicare program. Taiwan solved their health care issues by adopting a uniquely American solution. Had we taken similar action in 1994, not only would we not be here today discussing this issue, our businesses would be more competitive and working people would be secure in the knowledge that regardless of the emergency or their job status, their health would be protected. In our union, by adopting the principle that we're all in this together, we've been able to control costs while covering everyone. It's time that we as a nation view healthcare the same way, because we really are in it together.
Thank you, Tom.
Well said. Doctor, or who would like to go next?
Thank you. Hi, my name is Tom Dwyer, and I want to thank Commissioner Leonard and all the other mayor and all the other commissioners for allowing me to speak. Definitely an important topic, and forgive me for some of the redundancy I may have between your important statements that you had made and mine. But basically, I own a small business in the Selwood area that I've had for about 28 years and employ 17 people. And like all small businesses, healthcare is a big issue for us. On a personal level, I had a recent health crisis of my own and found out firsthand how fast a $120,000 medical bill can grow. And I was injured in an instant, and thankfully, I was rescued by our single payer fire department. So I'm eternally grateful for that. That unfortunately was delivered into the hands of the not single payer healthcare system. But anyway, I was taken to the hospital and I was, you know, given the best care possible. And I'm one of the lucky ones. I had insurance. I was covered. My insurance was good, and I could have very well been another statistic, because that level of cost was amazing. Basically, the outrageous cost of the current for-profit health insurance and medical care are killing people and killing our economy as well. Basically, it's a moral issue and an economic issue. And we've all heard reasons, and like I said, bear with me and I'll repeat some of the ones that I had. And we pay more for health care than any other nation and receive far less, both in terms of access and results. Over 65% of all bankruptcies in the U.S. are due to medical bills. Tens of thousands of people each year die unnecessarily from the lack of care. 30% of the money spent on health care is skimmed off the top by profiteers who add absolutely no value to the system whatsoever. Well over 30% of the services that are needed by patients are denied by the insurance companies. Basically, we're not going to be able to compete on a world market with the cost of health care tagged on our goods. So that's another burden that we have. And even the people that report being satisfied with their current insurance don't realize that it's not sustainable, that either they or their employer may not be able to continue the escalating premiums. Basically, it's not a sustainability issue in the long run. The system's broken right now. I mean, there's people that are frankly hurting right now. And for individuals, families, and small businesses, it's critical. We can't wait. The nonprofit research group Kaiser Family Foundation reported that the healthcare insurance premiums rose 74% for small businesses from 2001 to 2008, and about 10% of small businesses are considering eliminating coverage over the next year, and that's up from 3% in 2005, so over three times more businesses are looking to cancel their insurance. Many small businesses operate on a very narrow margin, and with the healthcare costs increasing several times the rate of general inflation, owners have few choices, but as indicated by Tom, to shift the cost to employees, cut benefits, or eliminate the benefits altogether. And there again, this is not a fault of small business. It's a flawed system. Basically, the way that we finance healthcare isn't working. A single-payer system is outlined in H.R. 676. Financed by a fair tax system would remove this burden from small employers and allow us to focus, small businesses to focus on growing our business and supporting our communities. In just the short time that I've been privileged to speak, 33 people have lost their health coverage, six have declared bankruptcy for medical bills, and one person's died while I was speaking, you know, at least one. So, like I said, this is not a problem that we can wait to deal with. You know, at this rate, how much longer can we wait? How much longer can we talk? All the suffering and death so that a few can prosper, it can't continue. I think we all know the real cause for our failure to respond to the healthcare crisis is a matter of corporate greed and the control of our representative form of democracy. So we need to definitely make a strong statement, and I appreciate your being here today to make that statement for the city of Portland. So please help us support H.R. 676 and make healthcare work again for us.
So Tom, you identified yourself as the owner of a small business, and so you're going to require me to have to explain what that is. That's Tom Dwyer Automotive, off Southeast Tacoma. It is the only place I allow any mechanic to touch my vehicle in the world. The person that testified here today has that philosophy reflected in his employees. They are outstanding, and I would heartily recommend anybody looking for a reliable person to take their car to go to Tom Dwyer Automotive.
No, not necessary, but you know, I'm here literally from my employees. I see so much of their income go to healthcare. It's just mind-boggling.
The more business, you make more money. Which
but still, healthcare costs. The ratio is still the same. It's just outrageous. I mean, we need to see some change.
Thanks, Tom.
So thank you, Randy.
Thanks for your testimony. Yeah. Doctor?
My name is Dr. Herman Frankel. Mayor Adams, Commissioner Leonard, Commissioner France, I'm sorry, Commissioner Fritz, Commissioner Fish. I started practicing pediatrics in Portland in 1965. I'm here today to thank you for this resolution in which, in one voice, you invite us to join with you in urging our elected president and representatives and senators in Washington, D.C. to enact this unique American solution to a unique American problem. You know what doctors want to do? Doctors, like other caring health professionals, want to take care of people. We want to work with people to protect and maintain their health. We want to work with people to prevent them from becoming ill or injured. And when people do become ill or injured, we want to make sure that everyone has equal access to the highest quality medical care. That's what we want to do. We don't want to be spending time and energy and healthcare dollars begging or fighting for permission from medical care insurance companies to provide needed care. So how does it come about that we have this unique problem, unique in the world, in which we pay a bigger proportion of our gross national product for medical care, bigger proportion than any other country? And the result, we have poorer access to medical care and poorer health outcomes than other developed countries. Why does this happen? It happens because the medical care system is not controlled by caring health professionals who are committed to promoting and protecting people's health, who are committed to working with people to prevent the development of illness or injuries, who are committed to providing the very best medical care possible to everyone without exception. The problem is that our medical care system, unlike the medical care systems of all other countries, is controlled by medical care insurance companies that stand between doctors and patients for the purpose of preventing access to medical care. How do we know that this is true? What I'm saying is documented in the written materials that I've shared with you, part of the public record. In the medical care insurance industry, payments that a medical care insurance corporation makes for medical care are considered losses. Got that? The corporation considers that a loss when it pays for medical care. The industry uses the term medical loss ratio to identify the fraction of revenue from a plan's premiums that it pays out for medical care services. So when the medical loss ratio gets reduced, in other words, when a company succeeds in reducing the amount of money that it pays for medical care by denying or delaying or rejecting claims, bonuses to employees of that corporation go up. Salaries to executives of that corporation go up. Even if the reduction is a fraction of a percentage point, and in the case of for-profit corporations, the value of shares of stock goes up. The returns to investors go up. Each time a medical care insurance corporation succeeds in reducing its payment for needed medical services. That's what's going on. The system works very well for the medical care insurance industry, an industry whose cynicism and greed are almost beyond belief. While selling the illusion of access to medical care as a marketplace commodity, it rewards its employees for denying access. It uses part of each medical care dollar for deceptive marketing practices, for advertising, for public relations, for generous gifts to elected politicians in Washington, D.C., generous executive salaries and bonuses, legal fees for settling cases of criminal fraud, and in addition, the existence of